The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, and I'll make an add to that announcement that so Diana Clark, who's been a longtime member here, is going to teach a class on this Saturday on the life of the Buddha. And I've been hearing her teach, she's been studying this for a while now, and hearing her teach about the life of the Buddha has been quite a pleasure, quite a delight. She's gone into a lot of depth in it, and I think she'll make it very interesting. And she has thought about this a lot, and so she can answer a lot of interesting questions. Like, one of the interesting questions is, was there a Buddha? And if you come, you can ask her that. See what she says. So in the time of the Buddha, turn it down a little bit, it's a little bit echoey in my ears. So how's that now for everyone? Does that work? Okay, good. Thank you. So in the time of the Buddha, he had this monastic community that were his followers, and back then the society was so much different than it is today that you couldn't just go down the street to Insight Meditation Center to practice, or you couldn't go to a retreat center. People didn't have built-in vacations, you know, for the 3 weeks a year, 6 weeks a year, whatever, from work. People didn't have banks where they could save their money and things. And so the idea of getting up and going to a retreat center and sitting and practicing and studying was not really a part of the culture or really possible back then. So what people did was, and who are serious about engaging in exploring the spiritual life, developing themselves spiritually, one of the main avenues available in society then was to become a monastic. Because in ancient India, to be monastic, you were supported by society. You were renunciate, and the food and basic needs you had were provided so you can do this important work that nowadays is much easier to get to. Even 100 years ago in Thailand, there are stories of people who would walk for weeks and weeks through Thailand to find a particular teacher that they wanted to study and listen to. And now all you need is your iPad. You know, and you click around a few times and there's probably an audio recording of that teacher somewhere or else to listen to. And I think it's a world of difference between just going on your iPad and hearing great teachers and you know, spending weeks going through the jungles of Thailand to find the teacher. I think when it's too easy sometimes, it doesn't go in as deep, or don't bring all of ourselves into it in the way maybe it was in the old world. So the Buddha created a monastic community, and a lot of the training that he had was done in community. The monastics would live together, and how they lived together was part of the training for this path of liberation. And that's sometimes overlooked here in the West when we teach meditation first and foremost, or maybe only meditation as the main teachings of Buddhism. And the emphasis sometimes is much more individualistic here in the West. And so the idea of being in community isn't so, has such a central place as it does in monastic communities. And also lay people have some squeamishness around community. And, you know, I mean, I certainly have a little bit, you know, here we are Sunday morning in what used to be a church. So we're not a congregation, right? And this is not a Sunday morning sermon, and I'm not a minister, and, but functionally, it functions, very much those kinds of ways. But, the idea that what are we, and how are we as a community? So in fact, the idea of practicing and training in community and rubbing up against each other in community is a time-honored way of practicing in Buddhism. It's one of what's called the three treasures of Buddhism: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the community. And a community is not only a place where people come together to commune together and cooperate together, get along. And I lived in Buddhist communities, like I lived at San Francisco Zen Center and other places. And sometimes from the outside, people here in the West will have all kinds of idealistic ideas about what these Buddhist communities are like. You know, they're probably, you know, floating on clouds, and they're probably all so filled with compassion and kindness, and, you know, and they're just like, you know, all their, and it makes some sense. I mean, people who get interested in Buddhism are interested in some beautiful ideals. They're looking to find an alternative to the life they live, the struggles they have. And so we read books on Buddhism, and they talk about wonderful ideals. And so it's kind of natural then to project it onto the Buddhist communities. That's where you'll find it. And you do find some of that there. But when you live inside some of these communities, you find out that it is not so ideal. And in fact, sometimes it's the people who most need to practice are the ones who, you know, end up in these communities. And because they most need it, that's because they have challenges of all kinds of ways. So what you find in many of these Buddhist communities is you find all kinds of interpersonal challenges that goes along with it. And what needs to be learned is to embrace those challenges and those conflicts, to see them as actually very, very important opportunities for a number of things, but opportunities to look at ourselves in an honest way, an opportunity to cultivate some of the important personal qualities that come with being in community. Honesty, feedback, staying present for people who are very different from you and sometimes challenging to you. And find a heart of compassion and kindness in that kind of environment. Find some kind of concord and unity that's possible. And in the process, people who've trained in community, they mature in a very different way than the people who don't do Buddhist training in community. I've seen monastics, Buddhist monastics, who've trained in monastic communities, and they tend to become much more generous and friendly, and somehow there's less rough edges around them. And I've seen Buddhist monastics who have not trained in community. It's possible to do that, kind of mostly stay on your own. And you can see there's rough edges or areas of the life they haven't really attended to, and it gets a little bit more difficult sometimes. There's pluses and minuses in both ways. And same thing for people who are lay people. There are lay people who really stay on their own and don't share themselves, not in community, and whole areas of personal development don't happen when you kind of do it all individualistically. And the people who train in community are really kind of involved and connected to other practitioners. You find, you see a kind of, a certain kind of growth and development. So in the time of the Buddha, he had this monastic community, and it was certainly not an ideal community. And in the sense that, you know, they didn't float on clouds and weren't just all the embodiment of compassion and kindness. There were some difficult people in the monastic community in the time of the Buddha that he had to deal with. In fact, sometimes apparently they were so difficult that maybe out of some wisdom that he had, he just left them. You know, I'm out of here. And he would go off to some other place until they kind of, you know, reformed themselves or figured it all out, and then he would come back. And one of these stories has to do with a group of monks in a town called Kosambi. And this is one of the more famous conflicts in the monastic community in time of the Buddha, the conflict of the monks at Kosambi. It seems that what happened was that, you know, the monastics have all these rules they have to live by. Some of the rules are just so we get along better and so things can be more harmonious. and including rules about how you're supposed to conduct yourself in the latrine. And the you know, outhouse they had, I guess, back then. And one of the rules was when you used it, you weren't supposed to leave any water in the dipper, in the water dipper. I guess they used water to clean themselves. And maybe it was kind of, maybe it was not so, I don't know what how they used those dippers exactly, but one of the rules is you don't leave water in it when you finish. Maybe it's dirty then or something. And so it's, you know, maybe, probably made good sense back then. There's more community harmony if you left the latrine kind of, you know, in a good place for the next person to come. So there was one of the rules was, you know, don't leave water in the dipper. Well, one of the monks left water in the dipper, but there was a rule against it. So that some of the people knew the rules, so they did a complaint, a formal kind of, you broke one of the rules. This monk refused to admit that he broke the rule. I didn't do that. I didn't acknowledge it. And it turns out that one of the rules of litigation, of working out when someone breaks a monastic rule, is that for the most part, the person who did it has to admit that they did it. If they haven't admitted it, you can't then have them do the next thing. You know, make amends, be in probation, or whatever. There has to be an admission. It's kind of like, because the expectation is people are honest. So we don't know if he did it or not, but he refused to acknowledge it. And so there was this big conflict. And in that conflict, somehow or other, he was banished from the community. But that raised even more conflict. And there were the monks who were on his camp and the monks from the other camp. And apparently some of the stories say that they ended up fighting, even. So it got that bad, right? Over water in your dipper. And so, you know, in terms of this being an ideal community. So at some point the Buddha intervened and he gave a particular teachings to them. And the teachings he gave was the six principles of cordiality, or the word is also translated as amiability, of friendship. And six principles. So that's what I want to offer you today, is these six principles. And these principles are a little bit organized, one of the things they have in common is the phrase, in public and in private. So certain ways of behaving, both openly, so other people can see it, and also the word could be hidden or covered, so no one knows you're doing it. Secret acts of kindness. So it starts off, three of these principles of cordiality have to do with loving kindness. And then as we get to the end of it, it begins shifting from how you relate to others to how you practice for yourself. And the final one is said to be the most important one. And what's nice when you hear it is to realize it's being presented in the context of creating greater harmony and concord and friendship in the community. That there's a relationship between personal practice and the effect it has on the community around us. And it goes in both ways. It's a wonderful mutuality between doing your own practice and becoming a better person that way, and then that creates better social conditions around you. You can be more friendly and supportive of others. And the more you are kind and friendly to others, that supports you in your practice as well. So the two go hand in hand. So these are the six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. There's a high value in unity, a community coming together and being in harmony together. So this is a pretty far out, pretty cool, right? And these things create love and respect, cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. And you find, here, a monastic maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his or her companions in the holy life. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So to make bodily acts of loving kindness. So that loving kindness, metta, goodwill, friendliness, these are all translations of the word metta, gets a very high value in the monastic community, in the teachings of the Buddha. You see, over and over again, there's an expectation that the Buddhist monastics are going to have loving kindness to their fellow monastics, to the village that supports them. If you're supported by a village, it says you should be kind of showering that whole area with loving kindness to people who are challenging to you, people who are your, you know, very challenging, people you're in conflict with. It's an expectation that they're also, you're supposed to have loving kindness to them as well. So there's high, high expectation that loving kindness is one of the primary attitudes with which monastics would live their life, I think is a beautiful thing. And it starts off, this first principle is to do that bodily, physically, actually do things. The second principle is to do that verbally, to say words of loving kindness. And the third one is to have mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private. So the first three of these principles, cordiality, has to do with loving kindness. And the mental ones, the private, in your own mind, is to reflect and have and arouse attitudes, thoughts, reflections that bring goodwill towards the people around you. And then the second one, the verbal ones, is to say that. To say words of goodwill to other people. Be friendly to people. And, you know, say nice things. Say things that makes them feel connected in a nice, warm way. Say you appreciate them. Make a difference in people's lives by words of loving kindness. And then the first one is physical. And what those physical expressions would be, maybe, I'm not sure what that means, but it could be giving people gifts. One of the great ways of creating social harmony among your enemies is to give a gift. Try it. If you have a relative that you're in conflict with, and, you know, I've known people who had in-laws that you know, they really had challenging in-laws, and one of the in-laws just wouldn't speak to the daughter-in-law or something. And so the daughter-in-law started to bring gifts, just very small things. Here. And then also would say simple nice things. Oh, you know, what a nice set of whatever, nice flower bouquet, nice meal you made. And just, you know, acts of loving kindness, thoughts of loving kindness. And also this mental aspect of loving kindness, I believe it makes a big difference. You know, this is kind of superstitious thinking, but over and over again, myself and other people have seen that if in your heart you can genuinely shift to think about some or approach or feel goodwill to someone who you resentful for, something changes in the environment. Maybe they pick it up indirectly, or they kind of feel it in you or something. But even if you change, sometimes it changes what goes on around. So the Buddha's first three principles has to do with developing loving kindness, finding it. And I'm not going to suggest that that's always easy. In fact, the more difficult it is, probably the more valuable it is to be up against it. Not because it's an obligation, not because you're supposed to kind of force yourself to have goodwill. There should be no forcing here, no obligation. It should really be something that you want to do. And that you want to do the inner work that it takes to find how to have goodwill and friendliness to others. And if you don't have that desire that comes naturally for you, then it might be very interesting to kind of spend some time looking at that. What's going on in you? And this whole, one of the whole aspects of this, especially when it's challenging, is how do you benefit? How does it support you? It probably doesn't support you very well to continue with a grudge. Probably doesn't support you to have hostility towards others or animosity towards others. It's painful. It's a drag. You go around kind of, you know, wearing yourself down with it, closing yourself down. So to do the work, to look at resentment, to look at hostility, to look at what we're holding against people, is a very important part of Buddhist practice on the path of liberation, because you cannot be free if you're caught in hostility. You cannot be free if you're closed down. And so what are you mostly committed to? What are you mostly interested in? What has the highest value for you? Is the highest value for you to be angry or to be friendly? And the way some people behave, it's clear the answer is to be hostile. I mean, really clear. That there's somehow that they, people hold on that really, really strongly. I read an article this morning about a man in Boston or in Massachusetts who was angry at one of the doctors who was caring for his, doing, helping surgery for his very old and frail mother who died in the surgery. And he was so angry at the surgeon that he went and shot him. You know, so I mean, that's so important to hold on to that anger for whatever reason. So what is the inner work that has to happen to be able to have loving kindness? So remember, the Buddha is talking to these monks who are fighting, right? And saying, look, you guys, loving kindness is important here. Are you being kind to each other when you're having this fight? What's this about? So to do acts of loving kindness. One of the things that I've learned, I've said this many times, is if I have some irritation or resentment towards someone, there's a world of difference for me having it in the abstract, you know, having it in my own mind and not being around the person versus being physically with a person. And I've learned that I can't really trust my mind very well. If I have an irritation or some difficulty with someone, if I'm not sitting with them, because it's so easy to kind of carry, oh, you know, whatever. And so I make it a point, whenever I feel some irritation, some resentment or something, annoyance or something, to try to find them and kind of sit down with them. And because I find that I can't keep it very long if I actually see them and with them. And then I can find my way with it and work it out. And I've done that sometimes with great conflict with people. Some years ago, 5-6 years ago, I had a tremendous interpersonal challenge with one person, and I said, he was very angry with me, and I said, let's go have lunch, and he said yes, and it didn't like solve everything and cure everything, but it was quite a remarkable difference to sit down and have lunch with this man than it was for us to kind of like be, you know, in opposite continents, you know, and whatever, you know, opposite mental continents, you know, just kind of doing our little thing with our own little minds. So maybe you can trust your mind better than mine, but you know, maybe you have wiser minds, but I know that's one area where I'm subject to delusion. So that's, and my way to overcome it is to go meet the person. So then the fourth principle of cordiality is a monastic uses things in common with his or her virtuous companions in the holy life. Without making reservations, he or she shares with them anything that's been acquired, that has been acquired according to the Dharma. So here, the idea is the monastic shares what they have with others. And the idea of sharing, being generous, holding things in common, I think is a beautiful ideal. And not just mine, it's mine, it's mine. You know, does anything really belong to you? Probably a lot of things belong to you. But is it, you know, how important is it for it to belong to you? And to what degree does what you have belong to others too? Does it really belong to our world, you know, your possessions, my money? You know, my house, my car, my this, my that. Does it really belong to you? Where does it come from? And does it belong to all of us to some degree? You know, it's my plastic container of dish soap. And no one's going to have my plastic container of dish soap. But then we empty all the dish soap, right? It's all empty. And then we toss out that plastic container. It's not mine anymore. Now it's someone else's problem. The recology, the garbage collectors, it's their problem, Someone needs to recycle it. They better, it's not my, so it's mine at a certain point, but then it's society's. Where's the line? Where's the line between when it's mine and when it's society's, and how much do we share with the world around us? It was very hard for me when I was 17. When I was 17, I had a summer kind of being a hippie in Europe. And I traveled around in a Volkswagen van with four other friends, old, beat up Volkswagen van. And we went down to communist Yugoslavia and Greece, and we had almost no money at all. I think I had $50 for the trip. And so we ate, our diet was bread and condensed milk. Somehow that seemed like, to get by on. But it was really great. I mean, these little commune on wheels, and I loved it. And one of the people we were with, the guy who was a little bit older than us, we were 17 and he was 19, he was looking for to make the big hash deal. And bring it back to Holland and make all this money. So we were driving. One of the things we did then was we were driving around looking for where we can score. And now it seems ridiculous, right? Communist Yugoslavia looking for... we all went down to Athens. Luckily, we never found anything. The only thing we had all these addresses. We'd go. We had this address in Belgrade, and we pulled in the evening in a residential apartment building area in Belgrade. We had this address, so we went and knocked on the door, and it was the only rock and roll band in Yugoslavia at the time, so that was great. So they invited us in, and it was like a great little fest. And we slept there the night. In the middle of the night, the police burst into the apartment, and I don't know quite why, maybe because they knew we were there or something, and they wanted passports and the whole thing. There was no hash there, so that was good. So I got distracted. But we had almost no money, and we were traveling around, and so we shared everything in common. And it was quite a formative experience for me to be there sharing. All our money we had was shared in common. Whatever food we had was shared in common. Everything was shared in common. And there was a freedom and an ease and a friendliness and a familial feeling. And the idea of being all together was very meaningful for me. And then what was hard was when I came back to Los Angeles to go to high school and back to my buddies. And they didn't have that value at all. And we would go, we'd go hang out after school someplace and go to a burger joint or something. And one of my friends said, well, I don't have enough money to buy a hamburger or something. And I said, it's okay, I have some money. And they would say, no. They didn't want to receive anything. And I felt, I feel kind of crushed. But we're all in it together. This isn't mine is yours. And the feeling these walls go up and, that there wasn't this share was actually kind of painful for me. So this idea of sharing and the beauty of that and feeling we're all in it together. So one of the principles of love, of respect, of cordiality is to share our possessions. One of the things that's interesting here is what they say, share those possessions without reservations that one has acquired according to the Dharma. And what that means is that your possessions, your wealth, whatever you have, that it should be acquired in ways that are honest and compassionate and not taking advantage of anyone. And monastics, there's rules for monastics to not manipulate their donors. You can't even be suggestive. You can't like say, I haven't had any mangoes for a while. because that's kind of manipulating people, so. And so the idea is to be completely clean and whatever you acquire, you feel really good about. That it has come to you in a very ethical way. So that stuff you can share. And then the fifth principle of cordiality is a monastic dwells in public and in private, possessing in common with the others those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and conducive to concentration. So here, we talked about living in a virtuous way. So ethics, being virtuous, is also a very, very high value in the Buddhist path. And here you start seeing a shift in the discussion, because it says here, it says those virtues that are unblemished, but it also says the ones those that are liberating. So virtue being liberating, again, this whole idea of not being caught or stuck, obsessed, having the heart, the mind set free and open, is kind of the measure and the direction for all things Buddhist. And so one of the purposes of living a virtuous life is not, again, because it's moralistic, like thou shalt, but because it's liberating for you. You benefit from it. You're actually much better off if you live virtuously. And then, so the two personal benefits that are mentioned is it's liberating, but it also says it's concentrating. And concentration practice, having a mind which is quite stable and has ability to be very still and unagitated, is a very important part of Buddhist practice. And one of the ways of keeping the mind agitated is to not be virtuous. Maybe I shouldn't use that word. Some people, especially women, don't like that word sometimes. It's been used in the wrong ways. So ethical, is that better? That probably has problems. All these words have problems. And live with integrity, maybe. And to live with integrity, to live honestly, to live with by the precepts, is a way of helping you become concentrated, to have the mind that becomes quiet and peaceful enough to do the deeper work of liberation. So here we start seeing that the focus is on being virtuous yourself, and that benefits you, but also the whole purpose of these principles of cordiality is to benefit, to create harmony and love and respect. The two go hand in hand. And there's something about being virtuous or ethical that is conducive towards social harmony, that conducive to love and respect between people. And if love and respect in our society is important, that wants to be developed and supported. What do we do to support that? And so it says publicly and privately. I love this idea of privately, because one of the, I think, real litmus tests for your ethical behavior is what you do when no one sees. No one's around you. Are you only virtuous in various ways when people see what you're doing? Or do you do a whole bunch of things that you know are not right? You don't really feel good about it, but you know, no one's going to catch you, no one's going to see you. And here the standard, I think it's this idea of publicly and privately becomes very important. And again, there's no obligation for anyone to practice Buddhism. But if you want to practice Buddhism, if you want to practice a path of liberation, it's as important that you take care of your personal private life as it is your public life. You don't want to just have a public persona and be free publicly. You know, that's not really freedom. And then the last principle of cordiality. A monastic dwells in public and in private, possessing in common with his or her companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating, that leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So here, it talks about right view. It's a right orientation, perspective, the right understanding. And this is considered very important in the Buddhist practice, that when you're practicing, you want to have an orientation about what you're doing in your practice that supports you, that shows you where you're going. Without the right orientation, If you want to go to Los Angeles and you head towards Alaska, you know, you're not going to get to L.A., or at least not for a long time. So if what you want is to liberate your heart, to be free of suffering and develop harmony and concord in the world, then having the right orientation is important. This morning I was looking at some of the YouTube videos of President Obama speaking at Selma yesterday. And it was really inspiring for me to kind of see that and to see some of it. And also be reminded of what people did 50 years ago and to see that some of the survivors of that time still walking across the bridge. What a thing to have done. And to do that back 50 years ago in the face of tremendous hostility. And the dedication of the civil rights movement back then was to do it with love, you know. The idea of the civil rights movement was in fact to create harmony and concord and love and respect all the way around. And one of the people who walked yesterday was former Congressman John Lewis, who I think one of the powerful images for me in American histories is John Lewis going to the bedside of George Wallace and forgiving him. You know, John Lewis was one of the people injured on the bridge in Selma. And George Wallace was, what we know, the governor who was, you know, a very powerful racist who really inflamed the racial tensions of his times. So the idea of going there to his hospital and forgiving him was quite, you know, and somehow having this goodwill between them. So I was seeing all this and remembering all this, and then I saw this, you know, Obama speech, and then, you know, I did that what I probably shouldn't have done. I looked down at the comments. And one of the comments was likening President Obama to Hitler. You know, so the whole context of, you know, of harmony, goodwill, creating, you know, concord. And I'm sure that some people feel really angry about President Obama because they feel like he doesn't do that. He's kind of for some people, he's a divisive person. But to inflame and perpetuate division in our society, I think, is one of the great sorrows, one of the great sufferings. So the principles of cordiality apply to our local community, our family. They apply to our, you know, our society as a whole. And some of that involves having the right view. And one of the right views that in Buddhism is the view of the Four Noble Truths. To really be concerned about suffering, to see it as suffering, to see the causes of suffering and see the possibility of ending suffering, whether it's in ourselves and in other people. I think it's a form of compassion for ourselves and the world around us, to be interested in suffering enough to want to do what it takes to overcome it. And this is considered one of the most profound things that Buddhism has to offer. And, you know, if you read it in certain contexts, it can seem very self-absorbed. The Buddhism is about kind of helping you become free of suffering. Well, what about society as a whole? What about taking care of the world around you? And here, in this text, it's presented as this view is presented as one of the forms of principles of cordiality. And the Buddha said, of these six principles of cordiality, the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying, is this view that is noble and emancipating, which leads the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So here you see that the idea is that your own personal practice, you don't just do it for yourself, but you also do it for the world around you. And I think this is one of the beautiful things about practice. And I believe you can't really do this practice for very long unless at some point you're also doing it for the benefit of others as well. And a lot of it might be very personal, but you clean yourself up. If you kind of figure out how to do it for yourself, that is one of the great things to be able to help support our society and create you as a person who's a unifier rather than a divider of our society, of our families, of our neighborhoods, of our places of work. So six principles of cordiality, of how we can live in this world together with others. They're not easy, but they're really worthwhile to engage in this process of finding how to live by them in a genuine way. Good? So we have a couple of minutes before the tea, and I think because of the tea and because it's about cordiality, amiability, friendship, if those of you be willing, it'd be very nice if you just take a moment to turn to someone next to you and do a couple of things. Say hello, welcome them to IMC, even if this is your first time here. Welcome them, because we're all in it together. And then also you can invite each other to stay for tea. There's, hang out and talk if you'd like. Thank you for coming today.